A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's a man who orders beer by IBU, which is a bit like ordering dinner by calorie count. The question is, for the bitterness lovers out there, how far can hops actually be taken? What are the must-try beers? And how long have humans been making IPA in the first place? There's a lot to unpack here, not least of which is that ordering by IBU might be the most misleading strategy in the history of gastropub menus.
It really is. And I say that as someone who loves the number. I love that breweries put it on the label. It feels scientific, it feels objective. But it's a lab measurement that has almost nothing to do with what your tongue experiences after about the 80 mark. So if Daniel's standing there scanning the tap list for the highest number, he's doing something that makes perfect intuitive sense and is also, chemically and neurologically, kind of a dead end.
That's the contradiction that makes this worth digging into. A beer can claim 200 IBU on the label, but your palate checks out at around 100. Which raises the obvious question, what's the point of those extra 100 units? Are they just marketing, or is something else going on in the glass?
To answer that, we need to start with what an IBU actually is. International Bitterness Units. It's a spectrophotometric measurement. They take a sample of beer, extract the bitter compounds with a solvent, and shine ultraviolet light through it at 275 nanometers. The isoalpha acids absorb at that wavelength. One IBU equals roughly one part per million of isoalpha acids. So a 60 IBU beer has about 60 parts per million of these bitter compounds dissolved in it.
Isoalpha acids are what you get when you boil hops, right?
Hops contain alpha acids, primarily humulone, cohumulone, and adhumulone, and those are not bitter in their raw form. You need to boil them. The heat isomerizes them, rearranges their molecular structure, and suddenly they're soluble and intensely bitter. That's why early hop additions in the boil are for bitterness, and late additions or dry hopping are for aroma. Different chemistry, different timeline.
The IBU is measuring the concentration of these transformed molecules. But here's where it gets weird. There's a solubility ceiling.
Isoalpha acids can only dissolve in beer to about 100, maybe 120 parts per million. After that, they start precipitating out. They form colloids, they drop to the bottom of the tank, they cling to yeast cells. You can keep adding hops, but you're not adding dissolved bitterness. You're adding hop sludge that gets left behind during filtration or settling. The beer literally cannot hold more.
A beer claiming 200 IBU is physically impossible if we're talking about what's actually in solution. But how do brewers even arrive at that number? Are they just doing the math on paper?
That's exactly what they're doing. It's a calculated IBU, not a measured one. You take the weight of hops, the alpha acid percentage, the boil time, and you plug it into an equation, usually the Tinseth formula or the Rager formula, and it spits out a theoretical number. The Tinseth formula assumes a certain utilization rate, a certain boil gravity, and it gives you an estimate. But it doesn't account for the solubility limit. It doesn't know that the isoalpha acids are going to crash out of solution. It's just doing arithmetic. So a brewer can add a ludicrous amount of hops, run the calculation, and the spreadsheet says 200 IBU. The label says 200 IBU. The beer does not contain 200 IBU.
It's like calculating how many people can fit in a room by floor area alone, ignoring fire codes and the fact that humans have physical bodies.
That's a perfect analogy. The math says 400 people. The fire marshal says 120. The fire marshal is thermodynamics.
Theoretically, you could push it a bit higher with specialized hop extracts, pre-isomerized extracts that are more soluble. But even then, you're fighting thermodynamics. The most famous example is Michler's 1000 IBU beer from 2010. The name was the claim, 1000 IBU. Independent lab testing put it at around 110, which is still intensely bitter, but it's not 10 times more bitter than a standard IPA. It's maybe 10% more. The 1000 IBU claim was essentially a thought experiment you could drink.
a very expensive, very aggressive thought experiment, and that's where the second ceiling comes in, the sensory one. Your tongue doesn't care about the lab number. Human bitter taste receptors, particularly the TAS2R family, TAS2R38, is the one that gets all the attention. They saturate. There was a study out of Oregon State University in 2013 where trained tasters were given IPAs with different IBU levels and asked to rank them by bitterness. Above about 80 IBU, they couldn't do it reliably. The receptors were maxed out.
You've got a physical ceiling where the compounds won't dissolve, and a biological ceiling where your tongue stops counting. And they happen to land at roughly the same place, somewhere around 80 to 100 IBU.
It's a beautiful coincidence, really. Evolution gave us bitter taste receptors to detect toxins. Most plant alkaloids are bitter, and many are poisonous. We needed to detect parts per million of nasty stuff. But we never needed to discriminate between 100 parts per million and 200 parts per million, because at that concentration, whatever you're eating is probably not food anymore. So the receptors just say, bitter, stop, don't drink this, and shut down.
Which makes the IBU arms race of the early 2000s kind of absurd in retrospect. Breweries were competing on a number that their customers couldn't taste and their beer couldn't physically achieve.
It wasn't pointless, and this is the nuance. When you add a massive amount of hops, even beyond the solubility limit, you're not just adding bitterness, you're adding hop oils. Myrcene, humulene, caryophyllene. These are volatile aroma compounds. They don't contribute to IBU, but they completely transform what the beer smells and tastes like. A beer that has been absolutely hammered with hops, even if it measures the same IBU as a more restrained beer, will taste radically different because of the aromatic load.
The 1000 IBU label is a proxy for, we used an obscene amount of hops, and this will smell like a pine forest exploded.
And for the hophead, that's the appeal. It's not that it's more bitter, it's that it's more hoppy in every dimension except the one the number measures. The number is almost a vibe.
The musical equivalent of claiming your amp goes to 11.
Which of course it does. Because 11 is one louder.
Of course it is. But let me push on that a bit. If the number is just a vibe and the actual bitterness caps out around 100, why do some beers genuinely seem more bitter than others, even within that range? I've had 60 IBU beers that felt punishing, and 80 IBU beers that felt almost gentle. What's going on there?
This is where the chemistry gets interesting. Perceived bitterness isn't just a function of IBU. It's a function of IBU relative to residual sugar, alcohol, carbonation, and even the specific hop acids involved. Cohumulone, for instance, one of the three main alpha acids, has a harsher, sharper bitterness than humulone. Chinook hops are high in cohumulone, which is why a Chinook-heavy IPA can feel more aggressive even at the same IBU as a beer bittered with something smoother, like Magnum.
Hop variety matters not just for aroma, but for the texture of the bitterness itself.
And then there's the malt. Residual sweetness masks bitterness. It's the same principle as adding sugar to coffee. A double IPA with a thick caramel malt backbone and 10% alcohol will carry 100 IBU with surprising ease because the sweetness and the ethanol both blunt the perception of bitterness. Meanwhile, a session IPA at 45 IBU with almost no residual sugar can taste like a slap in the face. The IBU number tells you nothing about the balance.
If you're chasing maximum perceived bitterness, you want dry, not just high IBU.
And this is where the West Coast IPA became the laboratory for bitterness. Brewers like Stone and Russian River deliberately stripped away the malt sweetness. They used simple grain bills, mostly two-row pale malt, maybe a touch of crystal malt for color, but nothing that would leave unfermented sugar behind. They mashed at low temperatures to maximize fermentability. They used yeasts that attenuated aggressively. The result was a beer that finished bone dry, which let the bitterness stand naked on the palate with nothing to soften it.
The IBU arms race was really a dryness arms race in disguise.
And the brewers who understood that made the most punishing beers. The ones who just chased the number often ended up with something that was high. IBU on paper, but weirdly sweet and muddled in the glass because they hadn't managed the fermentation properly. It's like cooking with chili peppers. You can add all the ghost peppers you want, but if you also add coconut milk, it's not going to taste as hot as a dish with half the peppers and no fat.
That's a great culinary parallel. The fat and sugar mute the heat.
Same principle exactly. Capsaicin and isoalpha acids are both hydrophobic compounds that bind to receptors on the tongue, and both can be mitigated by sugars and lipids. It's why a milkshake IPA, which is a real style brewed with lactose and sometimes vanilla, can have 70 IBU and taste like a creamsicle. The lactose isn't fermentable, so it stays in the beer as residual sugar, coating the palate and softening the bitterness. A purist would say it's not an IPA at all. A hedonist would say it's delicious. Both are right.
Let's talk about what's actually happening when you push hops to the extreme. Walk me through the chemistry of a 60-minute boil versus a beer that's dry-hopped into oblivion.
In a traditional bittering addition, say 60 minutes of boiling, you're maximizing isomerization. The alpha acids convert to isoalpha acids, they dissolve, and you get that clean, sharp bitterness on the back of the tongue. Different hop varieties have wildly different alpha acid percentages. Noble hops like Saaz or Hallertau are around 2-4%. Classic American bittering hops like Chinook or Columbus are more like 12-15%. And then you have the super alpha varieties. Pato, for example, which was bred specifically for high alpha acid content, pushing 20% or more.
You need a lot less Pato to hit the same IBU as a handful of Saaz.
A quarter of the weight, roughly, which matters economically when you're brewing at scale. But here's where it gets interesting. The alpha acid percentage tells you nothing about aroma. Citra, which is the most popular aroma hop in American IPAs, has a moderate alpha acid content of about 11-13%. But its oil profile is extraordinary. Massive citrus, tropical fruit, lychee. It was released in 2007 and basically rewrote what an IPA could smell like.
Then there's hop creep.
This is one of those phenomena that sounds made up but is absolutely real and has caused brewers genuine headaches. When you dry hop, adding hops after fermentation, you're introducing enzymes from the hop plant into the beer. Specifically, amyloglucosidase and alpha amylase. These enzymes can break down dextrins, which are complex sugars that yeast normally can't ferment. Suddenly, the yeast has new food. It wakes up, starts fermenting again, produces more alcohol and carbon dioxide. Your stable finished beer is now re-fermenting in the can.
Your IPA is getting stronger and fizzier on the shelf.
The perceived bitterness changes because the body of the beer is drying out. There was a key study in 2018 by Vollmer and Schellhammer at Oregon State that documented this. Brewers were finding their dry-hopped beers developing diacetyl, that buttery off flavor, weeks after packaging, and they couldn't figure out why. It was hop creep. The hops were essentially restarting fermentation.
That's the kind of thing that makes commercial brewing sound like a nightmare of variables.
You're managing a living system from grain to glass, and then you add a bunch of dried flowers and the whole thing wakes up again. Some breweries now hold their dry-hopped beers at warmer temperatures for an extra week, specifically to let hop creep run its course before packaging. They call it a diacetyl rest for dry-hop creep. It's become standard practice at a lot of craft breweries that are dry-hopping at high rates, but it's a relatively recent adaptation. 10 years ago, nobody was talking about this.
This is why freshness dating on IPA cans is so critical. A fresh IPA at 60 IBU will often taste more bitter, more vibrant, more hop-forward than a six-month-old IPA that was brewed to 100. The aromatic compounds degrade, the bitterness oxidizes and softens, and you're left with something that tastes like hop tea rather than hop beer.
The degradation curve is steep. Myrcene, which is the most abundant hop oil in most American varieties, is incredibly volatile. It starts fading within days. Even at refrigerated temperatures, you lose a significant portion of the aromatic punch within the first month. By 3 months, the beer is a shadow of what the brewer intended. By 6 months, you're drinking a completely different beverage. It's why I won't buy an IPA without a date code. I've been burned too many times.
Which brings us to the practical question. If someone wants to experience the pinnacle of bitterness, the real, perceptual kind, not the marketing number, what should they be drinking?
This is where we get into the canon. And I want to start with the benchmark that defined the modern West Coast IPA, Stone Ruination. First brewed in 2002, right around 100 IBU. It was deliberately, unapologetically bitter. The name was the mission statement. Stone's whole ethos was, we're going to wreck your palate and you're going to thank us for it.
It became the reference point.
It defined the style. Clean malt backbone, no caramel sweetness to hide behind, just a wall of Centennial and Chinook hops. If you want to understand what 100 IBU actually tastes like, what the ceiling feels like, Stone Ruination is the calibration beer. Everything else is measured against it.
What about Pliny the Elder? That's the one everyone talks about in hushed tones.
Russian River's Pliny the Elder. Around 90 IBU, first brewed in 2000. It's arguably the most influential double IPA ever made. What Vinnie Cailurzo did with Pliny was prove that extreme bitterness could be balanced. It's intensely bitter, but there's a piney, resinous, almost floral quality that makes it drinkable in a way that Ruination's sledgehammer approach doesn't aim for. Pliny created the template for the double IPA as a showcase for hop flavor, not just hop punishment.
It created a whole hop cultivation effect, right? The Pliny effect?
Breweries wanted the specific hop character that Pliny had, which drove demand for certain varieties, particularly Simcoe and Columbus in combination. Hop breeders started selecting for those intense pine and citrus profiles because Pliny had demonstrated there was a market for them. A single beer shifted the agricultural priorities of an entire industry.
That's remarkable. One recipe changing what farmers plant.
It's the beer equivalent of a hit song changing what instruments manufacturers build. Now, if we're filling out the must-try list, I have to include Bell's Two-Hearted Ale. This is the counter-argument to the IBU arms race. It's only about 55 IBU, modest by West Coast standards, and yet it has been consistently rated one of the best IPAs in America for over two decades. It's all Centennial hops, a single-hop beer, and it proves that balance beats raw bitterness every time.
55 IBU, and it's routinely called one of the best IPAs on Earth. That should tell you something about the limits of the IBU number.
It tells you everything. Two-Hearted has this beautiful interplay between the malt sweetness and the hop bitterness. It's a conversation, not an argument. And that's what the IBU number can't capture, the relationship between the bitter and the sweet. 100 IBU beer with a heavy caramel malt backbone will taste less bitter than a 60 IBU beer that's bone dry.
Which brings me to Founder's Devil Dancer. This is a triple IPA, around 100 IBU, and it pushes right up to the edge of drinkability. Big alcohol, 10% or more, but it's dry hopped aggressively, and the malt is restrained enough that the bitterness cuts through. It's not a session beer, it's an experience. You drink one, and you've had your bitterness fixed for the month.
Devil Dancer is a fascinating case because it's seasonal. Founders only releases it once a year, in July, and it's a limited run. Part of the reason is that it's expensive to make. The hop bill is enormous. You're looking at a beer that costs two or three times what a standard IPA costs to produce, just in raw ingredients. And the market for a beer that aggressive is finite. Most people don't want their palate wrecked on a Tuesday evening.
On the other end of the spectrum, you've got the brewed IPA trend.
Brewed IPAs were fascinating. The idea was to use an enzyme, amyloglucosidase, to break down all the complex sugars, creating a beer that ferments out completely dry, like a brut champagne. Lagunitas Daytime is a good example, around 45 IBU. The dryness amplifies the perception of bitterness without needing a high IBU. It's the crisp, almost mineral finish that makes it feel more bitter than the number suggests. The brut IPA was the logical endpoint of the dry equals bitter insight.
The brut IPA also had this meteoric moment. It was everywhere in 2018, and then it basically vanished by 2020.
It burned bright and fast. The problem was that brut IPAs, in their purest form, are almost too dry. They lack the body that most beer drinkers expect, even in a crisp lager. They can taste thin, almost watery, especially if the hop character isn't dialed in perfectly. And a lot of breweries jumped on the trend without really understanding how to execute it. They added the enzyme, dried the beer out, and then didn't compensate with enough hop aroma to fill the void. The result was a beer that was technically interesting, but not actually pleasurable to drink. It's a cautionary tale about trends outpacing technique.
We've got the science of why IBU is a flawed metric. We've got the must-try beers. Now let's get to the history. How long have humans been making IPA? Because there's a story everyone knows, and it's mostly wrong.
The story everyone knows is that IPA was invented to survive the long sea voyage from Britain to India. The hops were a preservative, the beer arrived fresh, the troops were happy, and a style was born. It's a great story. It's also about 30% true and 70% convenient myth.
I love how you've quantified the myth percentage.
The reality is that strongly hopped beers existed long before anyone was shipping beer to India. October beer, A strong, heavily hopped beer brewed in the autumn for keeping was a well-established English tradition by the 1700s. Keeping porter was another. Brewers knew that hops preserved beer. They knew that higher alcohol and more hops meant a beer that could sit in a cask for months or years without spoiling. The concept predates the India trade by at least a century.
The technology was already there. The India route just gave it a name.
The first documented exports of hoppy pale ale to India came from George Hodgson's Bow Brewery in East London, late 1700s. Hodgson had a strategic advantage. His brewery was near the East India Company's docks. He gave the ship's captains generous credit terms, let them sell the beer in India, and pay him when they returned. It was a brilliant business model. His beer was pale, strong, heavily hopped, and it survived the 4 to 6 month voyage around the Cape of Good Hope.
It wasn't called India Pale Ale yet.
Hodgson's beer was just called pale ale, prepared for the India market, or something similarly descriptive. The actual term, India Pale Ale, doesn't appear until the 1820s. The first documented use was an advertisement in the Calcutta Gazette in 1829, East India Pale Ale, from a brewer named Bow. And even then, it was a marketing term. It wasn't a protected style. It was a selling point. This beer survived the voyage. It's exotic. It's for you, the sophisticated colonial consumer.
The name was essentially branding. India made it sound adventurous.
And it worked. The style became popular in Britain itself, not just in the colonies. By the mid-1800s, British breweries like Bass and Allsop were making IPAs for the domestic market. The beer that was supposedly designed for export to India was being drunk in London pubs.
Then it almost died.
It almost died. By the early 20th century, IPA had declined into a low alcohol, lightly hopped bitter, what we'd now call an ordinary bitter or best bitter. The term IPA in Britain became essentially synonymous with any pale ale, and not a particularly exciting one. Two world wars, rationing, consolidation of breweries, all of it pushed beer toward lighter, cheaper, milder styles. By the 1970s, IPA as a distinct, aggressively hoppy style was essentially extinct.
Then America happened.
Then America happened. The revival starts with Anchor Liberty Ale in 1975. Fritz Maytag's brewery in San Francisco, using Cascade hops, which were a new American variety with this explosive grapefruit character. Nobody had tasted anything like it. Then, in 1980, Ken Grossman found Sierra Nevada Brewing and releases Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, also built around Cascade hops. That beer, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, is arguably the single most important beer in American craft brewing history. It launched the entire hop-forward revolution.
From 0.1% of U.S. beer sales in 1990 to about 25% by 2020. That's not a revival. That's a conquest.
It's a complete transformation of what beer means to a generation of drinkers, and the engine driving it was hop breeding. The USDA's Agricultural Research Service, along with private breeders like Hopsteiner and Barth Hass, started developing new hop varieties with flavor profiles that had never existed before, Citra in 2007, Mosaic in 2012. These hops didn't just add bitterness. They added mango, passion fruit, blueberry, diesel, cannabis, pine, cedar. They were flavor delivery systems.
That shifted the whole axis of IPA, from bitterness to aroma.
The hazy IPA, the New England IPA, these styles are often only 30 to 50 IBU, which is less than a traditional English bitter, but they're dry hopped at rates of 2, 3, even 5 pounds per barrel. The aroma is overwhelming. You put your nose near the glass and it's like sticking your face in a bag of hop pellets. The bitterness is almost an afterthought. It's the opposite of the IBU arms race. Maximum hop character, minimum perceived bitterness.
Which loops us right back to where we started. The IBU number was never the point. It was always about what the hops were doing beyond the bitterness. The number was just the only thing we knew how to measure.
It's still useful. I don't want to throw IBU out entirely. For a brewer, it's a critical quality control metric. You need to know that your bittering addition is consistent batch to batch. For a drinker standing at a bar, it's a rough guide. A 60 IBU IPA will generally be more bitter than a 30 IBU pale ale. The problem is, when it becomes the only guide, or when brewers use it as a marketing weapon to claim numbers that are physically impossible to experience.
For Daniel, standing at that gastropub, scanning the tap list, what should he actually be doing?
First, ignore the IBU above about 80. Once you're in triple-digit territory, the number is theater. Second, look at the hop varieties. If you see Chinook, Columbus, Simcoe, Warrior, those are your classic bittering hops. That's going to be a piney, resinous, assertive bitterness. If you see Citra, Mosaic, Galaxy, Nelson Sauvin, that's going to be fruit-forward, aromatic, with bitterness playing a supporting role. Third, check the canned on date. Freshness is everything. A 3-week-old IPA at 60 IBU will taste more bitter and more vibrant than a 6-month-old IPA at 100.
If bitterness is what you're chasing, go West Coast.
West Coast IPA, absolutely. Clean malt profile, minimal residual sweetness, aggressive bittering additions, and often a dry finish that amplifies the perception of bitterness. Hazy IPAs, by contrast, have higher residual sugar, more body, and the hop bitterness is softened by the mouthfeel. They're wonderful beers, but they're not bitterness delivery systems.
The actionable advice is, seek out West Coast IPAs with Chinook or Columbus. Check the date and ignore the number once it crosses about 80.
Do a blind tasting. This is the experiment I'd recommend to anyone who's interested in this. Get 3 IPAs with different IBU claims, say 40, 70, and 100. Have a friend pour them without telling you which is which. Try to rank them by bitterness. The 2013 Oregon State study found that even trained tasters couldn't reliably distinguish above 80. Most people can't do it at all. It's humbling.
It's also liberating. You stop obsessing over the number and start paying attention to what the beer actually tastes like.
Which is the whole point of drinking beer in the first place.
Where does this all go next? The hop arms race is basically over. Nobody's chasing the 1,000 IBU dragon anymore. What's the future of bitterness?
2 things are happening simultaneously. One is the hop water phenomenon, non-alcoholic, hop-infused sparkling water. 0 IBU, technically, but massive hop aroma. It's the logical endpoint of the aroma over bitterness trend. The other is climate change. The major hop-growing regions, Yakima Valley in Washington, Hallertau in Germany, Saaz in the Czech Republic, are all experiencing shifting weather patterns. Drought, heat waves, changing pest pressures, alpha acid yields are becoming less predictable. Some varieties are struggling.
We might see a shift toward more resilient varieties, or even synthetic alternatives.
Hop extracts are already widely used for bittering. It's efficient, consistent, and you don't need to ship bales of plant material across the ocean. The question is whether aroma can be synthesized in a way that satisfies the craft beer drinker. Right now, the answer is mostly no. The complexity of hop oil profiles is hard to replicate. But that could change. And if Yakima Valley becomes unsuitable for Citra, the economic pressure to find alternatives will be enormous.
The bitterness itself might not change, but the source of it could look very different in 20 years.
That's the arc of this whole story, isn't it? IPA went from a practical solution to a shipping problem, to a marketing term, to near extinction, to a global obsession, to a laboratory for hop breeding and sensory science. And now it's facing the same existential questions as every other agricultural product in a warming world. The bitterness endures, but everything around it keeps changing.
The next time you're at a bar, order the West Coast IPA, check the date, and don't ask about the IBU, just drink it. Your tongue will tell you everything you need to know.
If it's a fresh Pliny, savor it. That's a beer that changed the world.
Now for something completely unrelated. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1973, archaeologists excavating a Tang Dynasty administrative outpost in the Gobi Desert unearthed a perfectly preserved ledger detailing the precise number of ink cakes, brushes, and paper sheets allocated to each provincial scribe, right down to a disciplinary note reprimanding one clerk Liu for using 3 times his monthly ink ration on what the inspector described as gratuitously elaborate calligraphic flourishes.
Clerk Liu, the original ink criminal.
Somewhere in the Gobi Desert, a bureaucrat is still fuming about that guy.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtopf for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this deep dive into the science and history of your favorite bitter beverage, leave us a review on your podcast app. It helps other hopheads find the show. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.